understand, then I guess we'll have to move on out of plan.
I like to feel that with Midweek Drive Morning Edition, we appeal to the canines as well. I mean, that's why we have our interior team. It's nice to actually have Beano making his debut there. It's always wonderful. And now, of course, we have a super sensational soul on board. Who might that be, Jessica Ward?
William Sitwell.
William Sitwell, yay! William, before we talk about how France surrendered foodie supremacy to the British, we've got a young man in the studio who's very, very excited when he saw you on the show.
Yes.
He's a young journalism student, Jared Johnson. And Jared, why are you very excited when you saw the name William Sitwell?
Because I used to work for Waitrose, and of course you edit the Waitrose Kitchen.
Regular fan and employee, so there we are.
Absolutely.
full endorsement, not that we needed any, William, but you are indeed a legend amongst all employees, particularly those of that supermarket we call Waitrose.
So why did they sack you?
I left for better things.
You left for better things. Oh, I love it. Top insult. Well done. Give it to them.
He's an Arsenal supporter. He'll come back at you. That's important.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't want to be your enemy.
Well, moving on, though. Yesterday, of course, the Telegraph was graced with a few words, and more indeed, by yourself, as the French government launches a gastro-diplomatic fight back to safeguard its national cuisine. William Sitwell wondered if such bravado might boil over. William, share with us. I mean, are we on the... You know, is this something which should be making the news headlines? It's across the globe?
Well, it has been.
Yes.
You noticed. You know, I threw 1,200 words at it yesterday, doing my bit. I think what's interesting is that this isn't just a sort of fly-by-night silly story. The French government is genuinely concerned about what is happening to French food culture. And I think it's partly stemmed from when the British awards, which are the 50 best, the world's 50 best restaurants, was published last autumn. There were only five French restaurants on that whole list. And the French were absolutely appalled. And you know, the French, obviously, as we know, take their food very seriously, have taken their food seriously for not just decades, but centuries. And so the foreign minister got together some of France's biggest name chefs like Guy Savoy and Alain Ducasse and got them in for covert secret talks at his ministry. And they've decided to sort of launch a fight back because they don't like the idea that British food culture is on the up and that French food culture is on the down. But it's happening. I mean, it's not just that we in this country now have and we can boast some of the best restaurants in the world, we can boast amazing producers, we can boast a burgeoning wine culture, an amazing cheese business, an incredible food retail scene, a blogging scene about food, which is unreal, a TV scene, which is just out of control, think MasterChef, think Bake Off. But also France, on the other hand, have got a 35-hour week, this kind of insane socialist stricture that is sort of strangling businesses and really making it tough for them to deliver. They've also got a growing fast food culture. You know, did you know that the French McDonald's business is the second biggest business outside of America? You know, they are sliding into sort of foodie oblivion, and they're very worried about it. So they are launching a fight back, and the fight back began at the Quai d'Orsay, which was the French ministry, where the French foreign minister decided to actually launch this year's Michelin Guide. I mean, I said in the Telegraph it would be like David Cameron saying, forget the Cobra meeting, you know, forget the election, I want to get the Waitrose Good Food Guide and we're going to launch it in Downing Street. You know, that doesn't happen here. So it shows quite how worried and nervous the French are.
As you lead in the article, France is panicking. As a New Zealander, Jessica, are you just sort of amused by this Northern Hemisphere battle, or you think, what's going on?
The rivalry has always amused us New Zealanders. But, yeah.
Because you beat us both at the rugby, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, every time. Every time.
Okay.
I do find this... The French, like, culinary has always been, like, regarded very high. But I do agree that they haven't really been showing off lately. They've been quiet. And the English are coming in now.
The English have arrived. Is it English or supposed to British, William? I mean, are we talking British foods
British,
here, or are
sorry.
We talking English?
I think we're talking British. But yeah. The other thing you need to remember is that for centuries, the British acquiesced to the dominance of French gastronomy.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, only until relatively recently, if you were a very wealthy family, you wouldn't let it be known that you didn't have a Frenchman in your kitchen. You know, and this is true in fact and fiction. I mean, look at Bertie Wooster's Aunt Dahlia at Brinkley Court. You know, what was the name of her chef who everyone tried to poach and steal? It was Anatole. You know, he was an exceptional French chef. So whether it's fiction or fact, you know, this has been a reality for hundreds of years. And what stalled our progress and our rebirth of British food culture was, of course, two world wars and rationing. Not to mention a kind of default
and because we were saving
love
the French.
Of suffering.
And because we were saving the French, he says, patriotically.
Yeah, but you know what's weird is that France has always traditionally been our enemy.
Mm.
Yet we were very happy to be sort of smashed by them at the dinner table. And I think that we're now, you know, fighting back. So I think it's quite an entertaining time. But I mean, I don't know whether New Zealand and Australia have similar ding-dongs. They're probably more interested in looking at their sheep.
Oh, Williams. How dare you?
He's feisty this morning, you
very.
Have to say. Exactly, yes.
I think we just tend to fight over who actually invented the pavlova. That's our main debate.
Really?
Yes, okay. It is New Zealand. It's New Zealand.
So you claim New Zealand did invent
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Pavlova. William, well,
but pavlova was named after an opera singer called Maria Pavlova. Mm. I don't think she's ever been to New Zealand, so I think you've lost that debate.
No.
Fight back, Jessica. You know.
Well, they said that they found it in a Girl Guide's recipe book at a very, very early date. And, well, Australians. It's a big argument.
Clearly, if it was
you have to look into it yourself.
You'll be claiming that you invented Melba toast next.
Wow.
Dame Nelly, a wonderful scenario.
Nelly Melba.
Yeah, exactly. You do wrap up with seven favourite French restaurants in the case of Entente Cordiale, of course, the top seven,
yeah.
Which is one for the Waterside Inn in Bray, of course, La Page in Paris, La Gorge de Pinafore, Saint-Tropez. An interesting choice there. The Racine in Knightsbridge, Daniel in New York, La Gavroche in London. Yeah, I'm not surprised to see that there. And in Dubai, La Petite Maison. Ironically titled, really, isn't it, for Dubai? Small little house. Very good. Any of those would I mean, are they equally good, or would you say that there was one?
Oh,
I think
if I had to pick one, purely because it's really relatively close, I'd have to say the Waterside Inn in Bray, which has had three Michelin stars for 30 years. And I'm not a kind of Michelin loving junkie personally, but the service is always exceptional. They've got the best sort of classic French dishes you could dream of, and there's Diego, the maitre d', and I mean, if you ever want to watch a man carve a duck without getting a single splatter of fat onto his immaculate suit, it's just worth going there just for his sort of magician genius. And Michel Roussigny, you know, he's one of the greatest chefs. He came in and revolutionised British food in the 1970s with his brother Albert, opened up Waterside, and it's been going ever since. And it's one place where you can always rely on being looked after. The food will be great. The wine will be epic, even though it's only French. But that's another issue. But they fervently believe that they should only serve French wine. And it's just a tranquil haven of serenity by the River Thames. And I suggest that, you know, the people of Lincoln save up their shekels one day and pile in there.
I'm still recovering from Diego and his amazing duck carving skills, which sounds like the band I've always wanted to actually set up. We should work on that sort of thing. The sort of conclusion of this piece, if France wants a stab at returning to foodie supremacy, it should take a few lessons from us Brits. Firstly, cast aside the tired and snooty obsession with Michelin. It's not how real people eat today. Welcome other food cultures to your table. Fusion is anathema to most Michelin judges. As we have done with great success, champion what you have. Wonderful small producers, meat dishes with no hurry. Vegetables, and above all, stop being so bloody French. It's Churchillian, William. Churchillian, you know. I mean,
when you read my words back to me, they take on a whole new dimension.
It's bringing it alive in every sense of the word.
Bring in some pizzazz.
Oh, super. I mean, how we actually move on from this to Paul Opacic and the business of murder, I don't know. We'll try. But, William, I gather next week he might not be with us.
No, I'm afraid I'm in Boston. that fine city in New England.
Oh, well, in which case it would probably be about 1:30 in the morning now, so it's not really going to be so it's not going to happen, and that sort of bit. Unless, of course, we transferred him on to the midweek drive on Wednesday nights, where it would just be mid-afternoon.
Switch it around a bit.
He'd be very busy in Boston, though. In fact, I'll be talking about Boston, because Boston and Philadelphia are one of the key sort of early colonies that are actually there. In fact, the Boston police station, or the guards, once had its police station door stolen, and then they put a few more guards on, and it was stolen again a month later. Standing. just a little bit of Boston news for you there about sort of the early settlers, William, if you want to sort of drop the thing by, as you maintain, obviously, the true journey there to actually bring back the colony. Because, William, that's your idea. Bring them back. Anyway, Jessica, last two questions for William Sitwell, please.
Have you enjoyed the midweek drive this morning?
Yeah, I mean, I've just learnt so much. I can go and spout all that nonsense back at them. It's true.
Exactly.
And will we be hearing, well, you...
Will you be back in a fortnight, do you think? Is it going to be a fortnight? How long are we spending over in Boston, or do we need
to... I'll be back with you in 2 weeks.
Well, a round of applause, please, for William. Well, he deserves it from a former employee, I think.
Absolutely.
So there we go.
And will you play a little bit of... play some Nick Drake, will you, for me? Northern Sky, decent music.
We had some French music, actually, lined up with Carrie Le Burn and The Lady Sings, J'ai deux amours. She has two loves, but you're looking for some Nick Drake. Well, we'll see if Mr. Drake happens to be in the studio. But Drake Duck, obviously keeping the line going there, presumably carved a line. Very nice to see. We've got the River Man. Does that help?
That's halfway to somewhere.
halfway to somewhere down the river. That's the important stuff. We'll press the button and then the magic will probably happen. William Sitwell, we salute you.
Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today. I don't suppose it's meant for me.
Ah, 21 minutes to 10 o'clock on Siren 107.3 FM, Lincoln's award-winning community radio service. The Riverman and Nick Drake are selected by William Sitwell there, taking us neatly round to another debut co-presenter on the show, a true wonderful acting genius known for a whole range of things, from being the Stephen Marchant on Emmerdale, and indeed Carl Costello in Hollyoaks, and Only Fools and Horses, and in Birds of a Feather, and in Heartbeat, Doctor's Pete. I mean, it's phenomenal. It is the man who is Paul Apasic. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, but I think you've got the acting genius confused with somebody else.
No. Listen, Halifax is renowned for its acting genius stuff. It's very important on that basis. And it's our case of balance here, because we had Sarah Cox, obviously, from Lancashire on, and we need your good self from Yorkshire to keep those Wars of the Roses battled through.
Absolutely. How is Sarah? Is she well?
I think she was on good form. I mean, it was tough to tell whether it was Sarah or her dog Bino, who was more lively this morning.
I'm glad you said that. She's quite a feisty character.
Well, it's okay. We felt we bonded. Although I'm surprised she hadn't received her mug from her namesake, Sarah Gayton. Sarah would be disappointed about that. She'd send a specific mug to her, and she'd be... I was going to say, Sarah Cox, are you the Sarah Cox farmer's daughter, Sarah Cox? But I thought, no, put up too much information.
No,
we're here to talk about The Business of Murder, the Middle Ground Theatre Company. It's on tour doing all sorts of things. Paul, you've got a whole range of things there, including, of course, folk from Shameless, amongst other things. On this activity and wonderful setup.
Yes, we've got a lovely lady called Joanne Hickson, who's playing one of the characters, and she's not only a lovely lady, she's a terrific actress as well. You'll know her from Shameless, and I think the other thing was called WPC 59 or something like that, BBC 2. So she's a terrific actress, and it's great to work alongside her. She's great.
And the Middle Ground Theatre Company, www.middlegroundtheatre.co.uk, it's just in case you want to actually sort of keep up with the show, it's very important in this multimedia world that we've actually got here. We've got a wonderful shot in the start there of the sort of casting, which we look as though you've got the usual suspects in terms of this welcome. And if we go to Current Productions and The Business of Murder, perhaps you'd like to share with us, Paul, in in terms of the excitement that this is actually going through. And as the Times has said, welcome to a thriller that achieves it all. The Sunday Mirror, the best stage thriller for years. And the Daily Mail, which I never thought I'd actually be quoting on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, but what the hey, the most ingenious murder mystery for a decade. So, I mean, they must all be right. So, how did you get involved with this fabulous production, Paul?
Well, it's middle ground, Michael, and he started off as an actor and became a director. He started this production company, Middle Ground, over 20 years ago now, and he's been very successful at doing so. And he's got a knack for picking the right play to take out on tour, and this is a great piece. It's a psychological cat and mouse where you're never quite sure what's going on. You have two main guys, and they're both convinced of their own opinions. One says he's completely innocent, and the other one says he's completely guilty. And it's the play about ascertaining who's telling the truth. And every time you think you've got it right, it takes another twist and takes you down another road. And all you've got is the audience going, ooh, because nobody knows what's quite going on. It keeps you on the edge of your seat right to the very end.
Yeah, you see, earlier Jessica Ward said, indeed asked me, was I a Miss Marple fan? I said, not really. Obviously, alluding to Geraldine McHugh and indeed Joan Hickson and various other folk, etc. But Jessica, does this appeal, The Business of Murder?
Yes, I think it's quite good. It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
I've got to say, Paul, Jessica is originally from New Zealand, where quite good presumably translates as this is the best thing ever, you know? So
It doesn't matter where you're from, quite good means quite good.
the strap line, just following the most ingenious murder mystery for a decade, Daily Mail, Jessica Ward, is quite good, really.
It's not quite a Miss Marple sort of thing. It's a much more modern, edgier version of that kind of genre. It's a proper 20th century, 21st century kind of piece. So it's not gentle. It's quite physically threatening, psychologically threatening, and very uncomfortable viewing at times. So it's about as far away from Miss Marple as you can get.
It doesn't get too grand guignol on the stage, presumably. Otherwise, it could panic people, really, if you have too much stuff.
Well, like I don't want to put them all.
Very true. Jared, any thoughts from
yourself? I was going to say, from the way you've talked about it, it sounds like it will work really well on theatre. I assume you agree with that.
No, he's going to deny
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I mean, especially if you think it's quite good.
Precise. I think it's time to press this button here.
Hello, this is Mandy Maguire from Shameless, and you're listening to Siren FM.
Just in case you wanted a sort of little kind of a Shameless connection there. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Thanks for that.
That's very good.
Well, I actually worked with Tina Malone from Shameless on my last theatre gig, Rita Sue and Bob 2. Mm-hmm. And Tina Malone was in that as well. So there's a Shameless connection that seems to be appearing at the moment, which is quite good.
Well, it works in every sense of the word. Astoundingly, the Middle Ground Theatre Company has been around since 1988, which is a stat, because I was aware of New Palm, or Napalm as it's often known to fellow thesps in all sorts of ways, but Middle Ground's clearly been keeping its jewels quiet in terms of its sequence and various other factors. But clearly, you know, we would not be doing justice to this phone link if we didn't actually go to that little section which said tour dates. People need to know where you are, and it's all right saying, well, in February you're at the New Theatre in Cardiff between the 3rd and 7th of February, you're at the Civic Theatre in Darlington between the 10th and the 14th of February. What a perfect treat for Valentine's night, you know?
I mean, oh, absolutely. take your girlfriend now, take your loved one and scare the pants off them.
Exactly. And then it's on to Guildford, Oldham, Bury St Edmunds. And why haven't they yet? Sorry, it's an old line, but I can't stop using it for some reason. It's just something about Bury St Edmunds, really. It's the Theatre Royal, Bury St Edmunds, between the 2nd and the 7th of March. You're in Hayes, Northcote, Harrogate, again, Devonshire, Eastbourne, Ipswich. Astoundingly, we haven't got the Lincoln Theatre Royal on there. That is
disappointing.
I know. I'm a bit upset about that, because I've got close ties with Lincoln, and there's a theatre there. Dickens, a friend of mine, who also does touring companies, he actually runs the Theatre Royal in Lincoln. So hopefully I'm going to drag him along to see the show as well.
I mean, this is the key thing. I mean, we must clearly work on developing that a couple of stages further forward. But certainly we're going to make every effort to sort of catch it one of those areas. In fact, I'm thinking as the tour goes on to June, 23rd and 27th of June.
It's quite a big gig.
Absolutely. No, it's good stuff there. We should really consider doing, as we have with various shows and things, following you through the whole system. Which means we need to ask you two final questions, Paul, at this stage. First of all, have you found this a reasonably okay interview? Has it been all right with your good self, or has it indeed been quite good?
Well, I'd say it's been more than quite good. It's been really good. It's the Yorkshire version of a New Zealand, quite good.
Exactly. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to maybe actually featuring you again on a fairly regular basis as the tour proceeds around the country?
Absolutely, no problem at all. I will keep you up to date with everything that's been happening, all the gossip and all the news.
Hey,
wonderful.
Paul has just developed into a new... I mean, he was a star already, let's be honest. I mean, I haven't had a chance to go through
his...
Indeed. But he's now actually sort of... He's going into that legendary state. In fact, Paul, any particular musical choice you'd like? Because I think you deserve this to actually... Any particular artist?
We'll see if we've actually got that there. Play something by the Killers, if you would. All the Things would be good.
Do you know, I think you might be okay with respect to Brandon Flowers, of course, which I was thinking of an interesting name. It's Brandon Flowers doing his whole thing. All These Things I Have Done?
That's the one.
Is that the one we're actually looking for? Mr. Computer in Gratitude for Paul Opacic. The pronunciation of your surname once again. Well, obviously, we can say it's the legendary Paul, but it is.
That's fine.
Brilliant.
Bravo.
There we are. Here, your little treat, the Killers. Paul, take care. We salute you.
Lovely talking to you. Bye bye.
About to say farewell and happy trails to Jessica and Jared, which we are because they're off to shorthand, but not before we can actually say a happy hello and hidey hi to, live from her bakery in the joys of Staffordshire, that would be, of course, Sarah Gayton. How are you, Sarah?
Hey, good morning. How is everybody?
Yes, that's sort of it.
Awesome.
And, of course, the response that Sarah Cox gave with respect to had she received Sarah Gayton's mug was, Jessica?
It was a no.
It was, she thinks Ken Bruce might have nicked it.
Yeah.
End quote. You can have a listen back to the podcast and just double check that through. I suggest you probably need to send another one down the line somehow.
Anyway. We'll get another one made. Basically, for the tour to Australia 2015, it's going to be so much fun.
Well, this is it, because you mentioned the A word again, but sorry, I know you have to leave the studio very shortly. Jessica, you'll be doing some work with Sarah Gayton, of course, and the Isle of Man. That's all be sorting through on that basis. But we did want to talk about, Sarah, your Farmers on Film later. Please explain why you're off to the House of Lords in the very near future.
Yeah, what it is basically there's a really serious issue that's it's ripping through Britain at the moment. It's a problem where councils are putting in a system called shared space or informal crossings or courtesy crossings. And what's happening, the councils are taking out traffic lights, they're taking away curbs, and then they're expecting blind people and the general public to cross the road using their eyes. They want people to use their eyes to tell the traffic, to communicate with the traffic that they want to cross the road. And what's happened, Alex, is the fact is that these blind people cannot use these systems. They cannot use shared space. Guide dogs tell them they cannot go in there. And what happens is they become their own town centres that they know they can navigate before all these changes, to become their go zones. And we made a film about 15 months ago now, and we put it into the House of Lords, premiered it on the UN Day for the International Day for Disabilities. And it's such a powerful film. It's an absolute contemporary look at how blind people are being totally ignored in this country. Britain has forgotten to design them into the road system. So we went down to Parliament, or to Number 10, just before Christmas, and we asked for public inquiry on this. I have been turned down, but what happened after Christmas is that a question was asked in the House of Lords. Tommy McVeigh got up there and he asked the floor, he said, this is a problem, what's going on and what is the government going to do about it? The Lord Chris Holmes gave a passionate, passionate speech about his problems. He's a guide dog user, he's blind, he's one of the best Paralympic athletes that this country has seen. He cannot use these schemes. So suddenly the whole House of Lords was woken up to this. And when they did challenge the Baroness Kramer, the Minister for Transport, they asked if we could go and have a meeting. So there's going to be Lord Tommy McVeigh, there's going to be Lord Lowe, who's a blind peer, and also Lord Holmes, who's a blind peer. And yesterday I got the most unexpected phone call and they've asked me to go with them. And I'm absolutely honoured that we can go and present the data, the information, the films, not just in one place, but many, many places across this country that are now not accessible for blind people.
Sarah, again, outstanding work there. This is on the 24th of February. You're actually heading down to the House of Lords for that with Lord Holmes and Baroness Kramer and so on. Very briefly, Jared, any questions or thoughts on this one?
Is this a part of a wider problem where disability kind of gets looked out of mainstream policy making?
I think so. What I did, well, they had a meeting last year, the disability minister had a meeting to try and pull all the other ministers in to talk about disability being a cross-party issue and a cross-departmental issue, because disability should not be political, and it does have a whole... It impacts on every single part of policy of government. So he tried to do this, and I tried to tell the minister then that you should really look at shared space, because this is a fundamental issue affecting not just blind people, but a lot of vulnerable disabled people. And you're right, I think there's a complete lack of awareness, a lack of understanding, and a sort of a rush to try and regenerate local town centres for economic development. But if you forget part of society that is also part of the local economy, part of the social fabric of our towns and centres, you're not going to get that true economic regeneration that they're looking for. They're going to get a community that is well, what the blind people are calling it, is an apartheid on our British streets. And you know what? I'm not going to be part of that. I'm not a part of this society that excludes blind people from our town centres. It's just not. It's not right, and it's against the law as well.
Sarah, we will follow this thing with keen awareness, and obviously I wish you very well, for all the best from that point of view. Jessica, thoughts from yourself?
I think it's great what you're doing. So many people, they'll agree with you, but they won't actually try to... I suppose, make a difference. So.
That's where our midweek drive-outs, actually, they will march with the whole thing, they'll campaign, they'll do that sort of stuff for Farmers on Film, through to this campaign for the traffic systems for the visually impaired, which Sarah is working on. Splendid stuff. We thank Gabriella Peralta from Gibraltar, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Paul Surridge from Sightcare, Sarah Cox, and of course Bino, and pet nutritionist Joe Gale, William Sitwell, Paul Patchich, or Patik, and Sarah Gayton, and you, dear listener, for being with us. Thank you, Jerry Johnson and Jessica Ward. Last two questions for Sarah Gayton, please. Jessica.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
Oh, absolutely. And can I just say one last little thing as well that's really, really powerful that's happened? Well, two things, actually. Lord Holmes has blogged about this issue on Shared Space, and also Guide Dogs have done, 6 days ago, have done a film at Poynton Shared Space, and they are showing exactly the same problems as our film. So suddenly, people are waking up to this issue, and it is so powerful.
Mm. And the next one.
Will we be hearing from you in the near future?
Oh, absolutely.
Staffordshire's Force of Energy. And, of course, she'll be heading off to Australia as well. Heaven help them. Sarah Gayton from Staffordshire. Take care. See you soon.
Bye-bye. Holding hands, we both have been.